Good afternoon, and welcome to the 2007 broadcast season of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society's Fireside Chats on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldone, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law, and moderator for this year's chats. As our listening audience may know, the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society preserves and shares the history of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and of the securities industry through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum's collection of over 2,000 materials, not easily available through other online sources, is free and accessible worldwide at all times. The Society and the virtual museum are both separate and independent of the SEC and receive no federal funding. I'm pleased to introduce ASECA, the Association of SEC Alumni, Inc., as a new sponsor for the 2007 Fireside Chats, and to welcome back Pfizer, Inc. as a returning sponsor. Their support, along with gifts and grants from many other institutions and individuals, will help make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum this year. We launch our 2007 Fireside Chat season with The View from Congress of the SEC and of the Securities Industry, considering both the current mindset and the view looking back over previous years. With last year's midterm elections giving the Democratic Party control of both the House of Representatives and the Senate for the first time in over a decade, this seems an appropriate time to discuss how shifting political mandates shape the legislative impact on both the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and the securities industry here in the United States and abroad. Joining me this afternoon are two senior staff members from the U.S. Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, Dean V. Shahinian, Democratic Senior Counsel, and Justin D. Daly, Counsel. Their collective work has included staffing a number of oversight and nomination hearings, assisting in the negotiating and drafting of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, and discussing legislative and regulatory issues with representatives of federal and state agencies, trade associations, securities firms, and many others. The remarks made today are solely those of the speakers and are not representative of the society. Our speakers cannot give legal or investment advice. Dean and Justin, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It probably would be useful to at least some in the audience to start with the structure of the House and Senate committees dealing with securities matters. Dean, could you give us a very brief rundown on how a securities initiative becomes a law?
Certainly. Well, a securities law is generally created when the chairman of the Committee of Jurisdiction in the Senate, the Banking Committee in the House, the Financial Services Committee, decides to draft and move legislation. He works with his ranking member to the extent possible and other members of the committee to pass it through. Generally, the chairman identifies a problem and determines whether it's isolated or systemic. If the problem's systemic, he'll then look to see whether self-regulation or government regulation can address it. If not, he'll assess whether a new law is needed and, perhaps more to the point, whether it's likely to pass. There'll be discussions with interested parties and hearings, and the solution may or may not be legislation. Back in 2002, with the Enron and WorldCom and Adelphia problems, the solution was legislation. However, in 2004, the Banking Committee held another 10 hearings on the mutual funds late trading and market timing. However, aggressive action by then Chairman Bill Donaldson and ICI and Paul Schott Stevens precluded legislation. They seemed to have things in hand.
What would you say the role of congressional staff is in setting the agenda for securities regulation?
Well, this is a bit self-serving, but congressional staff does play an important role in facilitating their boss's agenda. And you know, our job as congressional staff is not to formulate an agenda necessarily, but it's to carry out whatever our boss sees as a particular priority. So I do think it's important as a congressional staffer to always remember that, you know, we're here to serve the boss and not vice versa.
Is there a great deal of continuity in the legislative staff?
Well, there is quite a bit of turnover on the Hill. However, saying that, I've been with the Banking Committee for 10 years. And
I've served on Capitol Hill since 1995 in different capacities.
Well, it sounds like you've both been there long enough to know the players, and one of the players that I'm curious about is the role of the lobbyist. How important a role do you think lobbying plays in the process, particularly the process of regulating the securities industry?
Well, lobbyists play an important role in really every industry. We have an open door policy. We speak with all interested parties. Generally speaking, there are lobbyists on every side of an issue. So we want to we let everybody weigh in. And but again, the our jobs are to formulate sound public policy, and you know, we take into consideration what they say. And as I said, all sides are represented.
Yeah, I think good lobbyists communicate information and identify not only the strengths but the weaknesses of their principals' positions, as well as the strengths and weaknesses of the opponent's positions. And that can be very valuable. They also perform a function, I guess one might call it herding cats. If you've got a highly contentious piece of legislation, the lobbyists can form coalitions so that the staff or the members are dealing with a limited number of people on any given issue, which is helpful in moving the process along.
That's interesting. How closely does the staff work with the staff of the SEC in formulating various initiatives?
Well, I think the relationships with the SEC staff are very close. I think they're cordial. We receive briefings by telephone, in person, from the staff. We call upon them frequently to provide technical advice on proposed legislation or at other times. We see them at seminars, hearings, receptions, homecoming, at SEC Speaks. As a former SEC staffer, you know, I feel particularly close to the commission staff and have many friends there.
We work closely with the SEC staff. They're it's very professional workforce. And they really are one of the best sources of information for us on the Hill, because they have very specialized areas of expertise. And on the Hill, necessarily, you have to be a generalist, because we cover all the areas of the securities industry, whereas, of course, at the SEC, they're they work in one of the operating divisions, and they can focus and specialize in a particular area.
I think that you two give me the perfect opportunity to ask a set of questions I've always wanted to have answered. I'm very interested in the subject of legislative intent and the role that it should play in interpreting laws, and particularly the federal securities laws. Do you think that such a thing as legislative intent really exists?
Absolutely. We, I think the members, when they pass legislation, have very clear views about what they do want to happen and what they do not want to happen. And they present statements on the floor. They present statements in the at hearings. They craft committee reports, which as clearly as possible outline what they do want and what they don't want to happen. So I think there's, at least from my perspective, legislative intent is a very real phenomena.
As a non-expert on statutory construction, I will nonetheless give an answer. Sometimes Congress passes laws that are ambiguous. Sometimes that is done on purpose. Most of the time it's accidental. But it just happens. There are numerous statutes that include ambiguous language. And to the extent that we need to clarify the congressional intent in a Senate report, we do try to do so. And we do believe that a Senate report should be considered when interpreting the statute, if there are, if it is necessary to resolve any ambiguities. But the preference, of course, is to draft perfect statutes that any reader will be able to divine the congressional purpose, but that just is not always the case.
I suppose that an academic musing is to the effect that the legislative history is largely a question of staffers' intent as opposed to necessarily the legislator's intent.
No,
and
is there a difference?
I mean, I can think of a few Supreme Court justices who, believe that lobbyists and other interested parties really draft the, legislative history. But, it's some, as I said, we can only sort of speak from our experience. We take the Senate reports very seriously, and we try to make them helpful and explain why we're doing a particular thing.
Indeed.
On a related but even more esoteric line, I'm curious about the significance of legislative lack of action. There's a doctrine known as legislative acquiescence to the effect that if the federal courts are interpreting the, in this case, securities laws in a particular way, if Congress doesn't do anything to correct them, Congress must be deemed to have acquiesced in the interpretation. Do you think that's valid?
I think sometimes it is, and probably sometimes it's not, I think.
Indeed, sometimes. In order to pass legislation, it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And it could be that Congress is not acting just because there are more pressing issues that it wants to legislate on, or it would be too tough to enact legislation. It does not necessarily mean acquiescence.
So, somewhat of a weak clue.
It could, though, as Justin was indicating.
I mean, if there is a clear and erroneous application of a banking committee statute, then, I think we would feel responsible to advise our bosses to introduce legislation to to correct that erroneous implementation.
Yes.
And would that extend just to looking back to interpretation of what the immediately serving Congress had done, or would you be willing to look back several years and try to divine for yourself what some prior legislature had intended and then try to keep the courts marching in line with that?
My sense is that legislation is moved primarily by the current chairman of the Committee of Jurisdiction. He or she has been elected for the quality of his or her own views and may not feel as strong a duty to champion the views of his or her predecessors. So I think there's the farther back you go, there may be less impetus for that.
Agreed.
And here one of the things obviously I'm sniffing around is the subject of continuity, mm-hmm. and whether one can reasonably expect to see flip-flopping changes in legislative agendas.
Well, I think it's an interesting concept, and I would just amplify what Dean said, and that is, at least on the Republican side, chairmen are limited to 6 years, and that 6 years goes by awfully quick, and the chairman needs to accomplish his or her legislative agenda, and I think the reliance on what past chairman did is probably not a significant factor.
A different chairman in the recent history of the banking committee, I think one might see different views, different priorities, just from Chairman D'Amato to Chairman Graham to Chairman Sarbanes to Chairman Shelby, while there was on different issues, and that could influence the decision of what causes they champion.
I mean, with respect to the banking committee,
to Chairman Dodd,
it does tend to be one of the more bipartisan collegial committees. We're not dealing with hot button social issues that for instance, Judiciary Committee has to grapple with. There is a somewhat of a bipartisan consensus when it comes to financial services regulation. It's not to say that Republicans and Democrats are always going to agree, but there is a general consensus that investors need protection. We need to stimulate economic growth. And how do you balance those two tensions?
So the goals are the same here? We're in a,
I think the goals are the same, and I think the, you know, that there may be differences, but they're more at the margins than sort of fundamental in nature.
No chairman or ranking member wants to preside over a crisis in the securities markets. They want to avoid that at all costs, I think, and in terms of legislation and oversight hearings and so forth. I think.
And I think, I don't know if this is sort of related in your mind, but it's an interesting question of how and why Congress passes legislation. And, you know, typically, if you look at, for instance, Sarbanes-Oxley, it took major, you know, corporate scandals and market failures for Congress to have the sort of political support to enact legislation, because it's just extremely difficult to pass any law, even if there are no opponents. And you know, if we have incredibly embedded checks and balances in the system, and this goes back to the first question, how legislation gets enacted. And it is very difficult to get sort of both parties and both houses and the president and all the financial regulators on the same sheet. And if, for instance, in the banking committee, if the chairman and the ranking member are not in agreement, generally speaking, it is difficult for that legislation to even reach the Senate floor. Now, I'm sure there have been examples where that contradict that generalization, but in recent years, that seems to be the case. And Dean certainly has served on the committee staff longer.
Well, indeed, I agree. You're absolutely spot on that. In terms of sort of how events can overtake planned agendas, I reflected back to May of 2001, and as you may recall, the majority flipped in the Senate, and on May 24th, Chairman Paul Sarbanes had a press conference, and in the press conference, he announced an extensive agenda. In the agenda were two words about securities: investor protection.
I thought you were going to say Sarbanes-Oxley.
No, and at that point there were many other issues that were there. He was very concerned about oversight in terms of housing issues, in terms of a variety, host of issues. However, the accounting and investor protection problems raised by Enron, Adelphia, Merrill Lynch, WorldCom, and so forth, overtook that and indeed led to 10 hearings and the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which, while not envisioned in May of 2001, I think clearly was a very, very significant part of his chairmanship of the Banking Committee.
Obviously, Sarbanes-Oxley raises a host of interesting issues. And the first one that I wanted to ask about has to do with what I think seems to be a shift in spirit, if nothing else, from some major legislation that had been adopted just a few years before, having to do with the deregulation of swaps, or making it clear that swaps were not going to be regulated as securities. Would you agree that that is a change in spirit, or is there something else that explains what was going on there?
I think the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, I think, was a direct response to the problems and the misconduct and the dishonesty that was revealed in connection with a host of public companies. And the constituent parts of it were meant to address that. Title I, in terms of the piece creating the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, was a response to perceived failures of the peer review. The Title II, which focuses around auditor independence, was perceived as a response to the situation where an audit firm would get twice as much in revenues from its consulting business as from its audit clients. Title V, in terms of precluding certain conflicts of interest between stock analysts and securities underwriters was a response to the perception of conflicted stock recommendations, and which resulted in misleading and sometimes fraudulent stock recommendations. So I think it would be, in my mind, appropriate to characterize Sarbanes-Oxley as a response to the crisis that presented itself in 2001. The Wall Street Journal talked, I think, in May 8th of 2002. They said, Main Street loses faith in Wall Street. The stock market fell below 8,000. A host of problems came up, which eroded investor confidence, as well as investors' pension holdings and the value of their securities holdings. So I think it's probably best to view it in terms of, or most accurate to view it in terms of a reaction to those situations as opposed to a particular response to prior legislation.
I would agree with with all of that, and just say that when Americans demand action on something, Congress is, if for better or worse, is responsive. And for about 6 weeks there in the summer of 2002, corporate governance was the biggest issue facing Congress. And Americans were, I think, reasonably disgusted with these widespread accounting scandals. And Congress responded.
As you say, for better or for worse, is there ever, in your experience, responsive, hey, wait, let's not rush to judgment here, let's slow down and maybe take a little longer to look at this and come up with a better product?
Well, in terms of the mutual fund, late trading and market timing issues that came out after Sarbanes-Oxley and after the global settlement with the securities analysts, I think there was a perception that that Congress would enact legislation. But 10 hearings later and a good deal of rulemaking in Paul Roy's shop down in investment management, and some very strong statements by Paul Stevens and ICI, decision was made that at the end of the Congress not to seek to move legislation. And I think as it's turned out, it looks like that was not necessary. The regulations and self-policing have addressed the problem. So in that case, there was a deliberate look in saying, well, we don't need legislation, at least at that time.
No, I would agree. I think that's a good example. And you know, Congress shouldn't legislate simply to legislate. And sometimes the regulators, in this case, the SEC, is the more appropriate body to address some of these issues.
There are times when Congress, when the chairman of a committee will call a hearing in order to motivate the regulators to take action so that legislation is not necessary.
Something else that Sarbanes-Oxley brings to my mind has to do with federal, pardon the expression, intrusion on a traditional state prerogative having to do with the regulation of corporate governance. Was that a big concern at the time, that the federal government was somehow doing something that intruded on the states?
There was an awareness of the role of the states in corporate governance at the time. There was also, simultaneously concern about the role of corporate audit committees, for example, whether they were in touch with the auditors, whether they were aware of problems that were discovered in the audit process. The provisions of Title III of Sarbanes-Oxley were included in the original bill that was introduced in the Banking Committee, and we were aware of, the staff was aware, the members were aware of potential concerns. While some of the concerns were raised, I think I'm speculating now, but I think the calculus was the problems are so severe that this needs to be addressed, because to my recollection, there were not attempts to remove, not serious attempts to remove those in the committee, and there were not attempts to remove it on the floor. By the time the bill came to the floor, WorldCom had just taken place. So by July 8th, after Senator Sarbanes introduced the legislation on the floor, members were getting up either to praise the bill or to say, well, I've got an amendment that can make it even stronger. Nobody was looking to gut Title III. So I think in terms of the situation, and I remember it being sitting on the floor and it being somewhat a dream, because in drafting, we were aware that parts of Title II may be taken out, Title III may be taken out, Title V. And so I was somehow, you know, I was emotionally prepared for, you know, one's work being, or work that one had participated in being taken out. But after WorldCom, people were just seeking to make it stronger.
Agreed.
You know, I know that this was before your time on the Hill, but it wasn't that long ago that Congress gave the SEC tremendous exemptive authority under both the 33 and 1934 acts. Do you think right now that the amount of delegation is just right, or should there be more? For instance, should it be up to the SEC simply to decide what is and what isn't a security?
Well, I think that the it's important to you asked, is it about right? I suppose. Is it too hot, too cold, just right? I suppose it's just right. You know, one of the things one wants to make sure that the SEC is adequately staffed to appropriately administer the exemptions that they have. In connection with Sarbanes-Oxley, I know there were some concerns about its application in Europe. And it's my recollection that Corp Fin, Alan Beller at the time, crafted some exemptions to take into account special situations which were consistent with the spirit and intent of the law. So I think the Congress was pleased that the SEC had the exemptive authority on the one hand. On the other hand, Congress is mindful of giving too much exemptive authority. I don't know how much is too much, but too much, lest the Commission exercise it in ways that Congress did not intend. So, and I think with additional exemptive authority, Congress assumes a greater responsibility for oversight.
I think it's a really important concept. It really strikes at the basic relationship Congress has with some of the regulators. And I agree with Dean. I don't know if Congress has delegated too much authority to the SEC. I think it's an interesting question. I also agree with Dean that Congress should give the SEC maximum flexibility so that they can carry out their mission. At the same time, Congress does have oversight of the markets and the SEC, and Congress, as an Article I entity in the Constitution, has a role to play and should be careful not to delegate too much of its authority away to the SEC. Yeah. So it really is a careful calculation, and I don't know if Congress has gotten it right, but it's something we do think about.
Well, I agree with Justin, and one additional aspect is that with more delegation to the SEC comes more pressure from interests that would like an exemption granted. And I think there's a sense in which the Congress may be better able to deal with those pressures than the Commission. The Commission is very talented and exercises its responsibilities in an extremely professional way. Having said that, it's there are pressures, and sometimes it may be appropriate for those pressures to come to Congress rather than to the Commission.
Obviously, something that's going on right now has to do with the ability to grant exemptions from Sarbanes-Oxley. And how do you see that shaking out, if at all?
Well, I think the chairman of the SEC has made it clear that Section 404 will apply to all public companies. So I don't think there will be a carve-out for foreign companies or for small companies. And you know, I'm not sure if they have the legal authority to do so. So we've seen some people suggest that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act ought to be put into the Exchange Act, and therefore, you know, under Section 36B, you would have the you would give the Commission the exemptive authority to exempt particular companies from the internal control standard.
Yeah, exactly. I don't believe Congress intended for small companies to be exempted from having adequate financial controls. You know, I think the notion that, well, if you buy a stock in a big company, you can be sure that they have adequate internal controls, but if it's a small company, no, you really can't. It seriously erodes the integrity, it seems to me, of the markets and raises concerns that don't have to be raised in terms of investors in small companies. So I think in terms of 404, it was not intended. And, you know, I think the Chairman Cox at the SEC and his commissioners and Chairman Olson at the PCAOB are doing a fine job in terms of the proposals that they issued in December. I think they've gotten about 200 comments, and so they're in the process, as I understand it, while we're taping, of working through those proposals. At least I hope they're working through. Are you guys working through the proposal? No, I'm just teasing. They're doing outstanding work on that. I think auditing standard 5 is a significant improvement from 2, and the guidance that the Commission is giving, I think, will be very helpful. My understanding is the comment letters have been very positive, and we should see some results, which will go a long way to reducing the costs on public companies for the attestation and on reducing the pressures on the SEC and PCAOB to so-called get it right.
There certainly appears to be a consensus that the regulators need to solve whatever problems there are, and that's from people who support Sarbanes-Oxley and people who oppose Sarbanes-Oxley. Yeah. So everyone seems to agree that Congress should permit the regulators, the SEC and the PCAOB, to streamline and make 404 more cost efficient.
Related to the question of delegation to the SEC is, of course, Congress's view of the SEC, and I think you've indicated a bit earlier that they hold the SEC in high esteem, and certainly securities lawyers and securities professors like to brag that the SEC is one of the most prestigious and most competent and adept of all of the agencies. Do you think that it's true that Congress might have different views of different agencies?
And yes.
Unquestionably. I don't think FEMA is a popular agency these days.
I recall the former Commissioner Beavis Longstreth said that the Commission was a jewel among federal agencies, and I think at least a couple of members of the Banking Committee have quoted him on that. So I think they're held in very high regard. I think one of the former chairmen said, good people, workable laws, and interesting problems. I'm not sure. It was the motto for the anniversary of the commission back some years ago, and I think that's true.
Sounds suitable for embroidering on a sampler and hanging on the wall. Well, that seems to suggest, too, that there might not be an intense degree of congressional interest in various proposals about forcing restructuring of the SEC, or that Congress might generally be willing to just keep their hands off and let the SEC take care of its own in-house issues.
I would agree with that. As you suggest, there are proposals out there to reorganize and restructure the SEC. I think a reasonable view is that Congress should allow the SEC to manage you know, the agency and structure it the way they see fit, and that if Congress were to involve itself, it would probably be fair to say, micromanaging the agency, and the agency is probably best equipped to restructure the agency if it decides it needs restructuring.
Indeed. There's no need for legislation on that, and the chairman have, the ability to do that. I know Bill Donaldson, who was the first dean of the Yale School of Management, when he went in, was looking at ways to tearing down the silos, I think he said, or promoting interdivisional cooperation. And there are various ways that could happen, or there have been some questions about other issues, and the chamber has a proposal for reorganizing the divisions, but those are issues that the commission can handle as they deem fit. I think the Congress is most concerned with the effectiveness of investor protection and promoting fair and efficient markets, and whatever organizational structure works best for that, I think people would be pleased with. And if the commission in some ways is not effective in that, they would just say, well, please produce the desired results, however you need to organize people.
How about proposals to do a bit more to restructure the overall regulatory scheme of the financial markets, for instance, proposals to merge the SEC and the CFTC?
We support that.
I have no comment. I'm aware of the proposals.
I'm just joking, but there are, these are, I guess, ideas that have been out there for some time, and many people point to the FSA in the United Kingdom, and they took, of course, 9 regulatory agencies, I believe, and combined them into one super regulator, the FSA. And the FSA generally gets is pretty well regarded, as far as I can tell, and I think as the markets continue to evolve in the U.S. and the New York Stock Exchange gets involved in derivatives, and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange gets involved in new products, and we're going to continue to see people suggest that maybe the SEC ought to oversee all of these different products, not only stocks and bonds, but also derivatives and other things.
Yeah. With respect, Justin mentioned, you mentioned the FSA, and I recall a few weeks ago, Sir Callum McCarthy, head of the FSA, was in town, and he took a card out of his pocket, and he said, well, I have the principles that we have here right on the card. And, of course, there's been a debate about moving to more principles-based from rules-based. And he says, well, I have this card with the principles on it, and there are 8,500 pages of text which explain these principles. So I know there's been that movement as well towards principles-based, but I don't know how that will play out.
Does it seem to you to be the type of issue that is more likely to wait for the agencies to cogitate and come with a proposal, as opposed to be something that Congress would necessarily initiate, barring a disaster?
Well, I think the Banking Committee would support, adding jurisdiction like any committee in Congress. I don't think there's a serious chance that it'll happen this Congress, and I don't know that there are any proposals out there to do it. But certainly, all the changes in the marketplace, is, I think, the most likely driver of this. I don't think the CFTC will come up to Congress and say, please fold us into the SEC. I don't think the SEC will come up and say, we want more power. And I don't think the ag committees will say, the banking committee can do our work. And so, I think you will need the marketplace to drive it, just like Citigroup's merger with Travelers helped lead to Graham Leach Bliley. I think it would take something like that to demonstrate that this old system of regulation is not equipped for today's marketplace.
Before we leave the topic of the congressional view of the SEC. Harvey Pitt, while he was the chairman of the SEC, stated that the SEC could basically do the accounting oversight work that was necessary, yet the PCAOB was corrected, was created. Why did Congress do that?
Are you speaking in January of 2002, his proposal? Because he did announce, correct me if I'm wrong, but in January of 2002, he had a proposal for dealing with this issue. And I think that the notion was there were two things. One, a preference for another body to look at. And, of course, the PCAOB is essentially under the jurisdiction of the SEC. They appoint their board members, and they review their rules. So, but there's a separate group that deals with that. The other thing is, if it's at that point in time, the proposal before it was announced, if it's the January 2002, may not have been fully vetted with Congress or with other interested parties before it came out. And I think the Public Oversight Board, Chuck Bauscher was the former comptroller, was the chairman of that. I think they disbanded over that in response to the proposal. So if that's the proposal you're referring to. So I think there may have been something in the process which may have precluded that from getting a further hearing. But that's my recollection.
I think that there are a number of interesting hot topics that we've touched on already, but we should take a few minutes to see if we can unpack at least some of them. You know, the scorecard, I guess, when you read the newspaper, would have Congress being prompted, of course, to revisit at least some of the requirements of Sarbanes-Oxley, being prompted to do something or not about the regulation of hedge funds, something or not about the regulation of mutual funds, something or not about proxy access. Could you expand on the list as well as perhaps make some comments about where you think the current Congress might be headed with some of these issues?
Well, you did hit on some of the most controversial subjects. I think in terms of hedge funds, Congress is certainly interested in doing oversight, and Congress needs to establish if hedge funds pose a systemic risk to the markets and whether there is this retailization of hedge funds, as some have suggested. And the SEC, I think, is responding by raising the accredited investor standard, which was, I think, first established or at least last updated in 1982, mm-hmm. Updated, I should say, in 1982. So it's been a quarter century since that time. So I think, you know, the President's Working Group recently issued a series of principles. And, you know, I think we're taking a look at them, and I think it's premature to say whether Congress will act, but it's probably less likely than not that there would be direct regulation of hedge funds.
In terms of Sarbanes-Oxley, most of the focus has been on 404, and I think the efforts of the SEC and PCAOB, which we discussed earlier, probably will diffuse a lot of the momentum to changing the statute. Because, of course, Section 404 is only about a half a page. It just says that management has to attest the fact that there are internal controls, and an auditor has to attest to the adequacy of those controls. And those are principles that people wouldn't disagree with. And hopefully, the SEC and PCAOB's efforts will get it, provide a framework for the application of those to smaller businesses as well as larger ones in a way that people will find acceptable. Proxy access is a very important issue. I don't know how that's going to play out, but I think it's very important. Institutional investors are very concerned about that. I think individual investors are, and so I don't know how that will play out now or in the future.
You know, I think on the House side, there has been legislation on proxy access. And, you know, I don't believe there's legislation yet introduced in the Senate. You know, I think some would be concerned about something that you raised earlier, which is the federalization of corporate law, and you know, has sort of Congress, you know, overstepped its role in the regulation of corporations. So I think that's an ongoing concern that some people would have.
And of course, there are a whole host of other issues that are sort of out there on the radar screen, which may receive informal scrutiny. Although formal, the executive compensation issue, I believe tomorrow the House Financial Services Committee will mark up legislation on that. There are issues involving market data fees, the improving regulatory effectiveness, the combination of the NASD and NYSE regulation, protecting senior citizens from investment scams, which is a recent initiative of Chairman Cox. The roles of registered reps and investment advisors, which have the fiduciary responsibilities. Developments in the options market with the determining whether penny increments make sense. The bond markets, transparency, new participants in the U.S. bond market, accounting developments, sale of securities over the Internet, the increasing incidence, not only incidence of fraud that takes place over the Internet, but taking those who commit fraud into applying sanctions to them. John Reed Stark's done a great job over at the Commission in terms of that, and a host of other issues that are out there. So,
I feel staff, inadequate. Dean keeps plugging specific members of the SEC staff. I think they all do a great job.
Indeed.
It's a global, global commendation.
Well, the way you lay things out, it does indeed sound like a daunting list. Do you have any to add?
Well, you know, when it comes to CEO pay, that controversy is not going away. And, you know, so long as people see a delinking between company performance and executive compensation, will continue to be a controversy. And, you know, is that a widespread phenomenon, or are there just a few boards out there that aren't doing their job? But, you know, I don't think Congress should be involved in this issue. Congress can certainly do oversight, but I don't think Congress should legislate on this issue. I think the boards need to do their job, and I think you know, shareholders need to have a say, particularly the institutional shareholders. If they are unhappy, then they ought to raise it.
And I suspect they will. Given the length of the list, I'm prompted to ask, first of all, is there really some way of conducting triage on these issues? Or does one simply wait for public outcry to point the way?
Well, these issues, I think many of these issues are actively under consideration by the Securities and Exchange Commission, are being addressed by and Chairman Cox and the other commissioners are, you know, Commissioner Adkins, Campos, Nazareth, and Casey are, you know, on the job on these things. So the expectation is that they will address these issues. They know them more intimately than we do. And if legislation is needed to address any particular problem in the marketplace, they'll come to the Congress and ask for legislative authority. Also, the states have a very important role, and so they're involved in addressing a lot of these issues. We're not waiting, you know, for problems to erupt and then say, oh, we can have a gotcha hearing. But instead, we, you know, we're aware of these issues and we keep track of them. And there may be some some benefit to the regulators to knowing that we're concerned about this, because that supports their efforts. And there are a lot of very talented and very very passionate people among the regulators who want to protect investors. And I think it's our part of our job is to support them and encourage them in their good work.
I think in an ideal world, Congress is proactive and gets ahead of problems and operates in a non-crisis environment. Unfortunately, sometimes there needs to be a crisis for Congress to act, and that's just probably the way it's always been. And certainly, Sarbanes-Oxley needed for the WorldCom bankruptcy to occur to sort of give it the necessary momentum.
Absolutely.
You suggested that hedge funds might be on the radar, and that seems to me to be such a large and troubling issue, and you mentioned something about perhaps concern about their effect on overall market stability. How does Congress actually go about acquiring the information that it needs on which to base legislation? Obviously, it holds hearings, but can you flesh that out for us a little bit?
Well, I think what we would first do is to seek out the most knowledgeable people in the markets, in academia, in among the regulators, and invite them to come testify before the committee and flesh out all the issues. I do think that, before Congress acts, we need to establish certain things, which is, there's a market failure. This is something the regulators can't do, and there needs to be legislative authority. So, I think the job of compiling the best information is very, very important, and it's something we would certainly seek to do.
Would Congress typically consider commissioning its own study on something like this?
Well, the GAO is often asked by banking committee members to conduct studies, and they do an outstanding job. Rick Hillman, we work with closely, and I figured I had to specifically commend the work of at least one fellow government worker. But, GAO does an excellent job. I think the SEC has been asked by Congress to do studies. They do an excellent job. And, you saw Senator Schumer, for instance, he commissioned the McKinsey group to do a study on the competitiveness of the market. So there are numerous entities out there that are able to conduct studies and help Congress do its work. And, of course, there's the Congressional Research Service, which does an outstanding job. So we do have a tremendous amount of resources, and we certainly couldn't conduct business without all their fine help.
Now, I can't let the hour end without asking an obvious question, to which I think I know what the answer is going to be, but obviously there has been a party switch. What's going to change as a result?
Well, I think the chairman and ranking members and their staffs will continue to work together collaboratively on securities issues, and there are many issues that are bipartisan in nature, so I would expect we would continue to be working to protect investors and promote fair and efficient markets.
No, I would agree with that. I think that the Banking Committee is one of the most collegial committees in the Senate and indeed the Congress. So, as a practical matter, the chairman and ranking member will have to be in agreement for legislation to get to the president's desk, and I think we're all aware of that, and so we work very closely together, and there is bipartisanship on the committee. I know that sounds idealistic, and we're not debating the Iraq war, and we're not setting withdrawal dates, and We are trying to establish the most conducive environment for investors to save for their retirement. So, which is obviously crucial, but it's not something that should engender acrimonious debate.
Dean, I have to ask, did you get a better parking place with the
No, the same parking place.
Well, we've got just a couple of minutes left for me to ask you each to polish your crystal balls, if you don't mind, and give a view on what change or changes you think Congress will have made in the federal securities laws in the next 5 years.
Well, in the next, events dictate to a large degree laws that would be needed. I think for most problems that are on the radar screen now, the commission or the state regulators or industry will probably sort those out, precluding a need for legislation. So it's difficult to envision major issues and not knowing what problems are going to come up. I think if you look back 5 years, you see Sarbanes-Oxley came up, but people didn't know about that much before the events of Enron and so forth. One issue that one might look to would be shareholder access. Conceivably, that could percolate to the top. But again, the commission is looking at issues and its potential solutions to that issue. But it's tough to predict with any accuracy.
It is a very difficult question. I think certainly no one would have predicted Sarbanes-Oxley in 2001. Or even in the spring of 2002, it took WorldCom in June of 2002 to really serve as the tipping point for legislation. So it is hard to predict. I think the area of alternative investments is something that's going to continue to attract an increasing amount of interest from regulators and from the Congress in the world of course, hedge funds and private equity and venture capital, and that sort of thing.
Looking out, say, 10, 20 years, obviously, you become even less confident in your predictions, but do you see a combined financial regulator?
Well, these are very speculative answers, but That won't stop us. I do think the U.S. will move to a more centralized regulator and sort of akin to what they did in the U.K. So that would be a prediction, that you would have streamlined regulatory agencies.
And conceivably 10 years out, I can't answer the other because that in part is a turf war type of thing. But in terms of, technology will increase a great deal over the next 10 years. And one expects that, for example, if proxies are delivered electronically, then it becomes cheaper to list shareholder proposals or shareholder nominees. And I suspect there will be an expansion of shareholder rights probably as a result of that. But whether that's legislation or regulation, I don't know.
Yeah. Thank you both very much. Indeed, I would like to thank you for one of our more stimulating discussions. And it's been very inspirational to hear how well you and the SEC have been getting along and the high esteem in which you hold them. And I mean that sincerely. I would also like to thank, again, ASICA, the Association of SEC Alumni, Inc., and Pfizer, Inc., for sponsoring today's Fireside Chat. This Fireside Chat is now archived in audio format in the virtual museum, so you can listen again to the discussion at any time. A transcript of the discussion, as well as the audio in MP3 format, will be accessioned in the online programs section in the coming months. We'll be shifting our discussion in the next Fireside Chat to the impact and influence of the federal judiciary on the SEC and the securities industry. Please join me, Paul Gonson, and Mark Kreitman on April 17th at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for our chat on the courts and the SEC. Thank you again for being with us today.